This is the UFO Files from Roswell, New Mexico. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we have our good friend Dennis Balthizer here, who lives here and has one of the great websites around, and one of our favorite people. Dennis, how are you?
I'm fine. A little tired.
Well, you've been busy.
Been a busy weekend, really has.
These people really turn out here in Roswell for this UFO celebration every year. I have carnivals. Even Willie Nelson was here.
That's one of the reasons I'm tired. I went to see Willie.
I was gonna ask you if you saw.
That's my bedtime.
Right, and we talked about it on the air one time before. At one time in your life, you were a country music drummer.
In fact, I worked with Willie in El Paso back in the early '60s. I have a picture at home of Willie Nelson with short hair in a tuxedo.
Yeah, we talked about that too when he had short hair, crew cut actually. Changed a little.
Yeah,
huh?
Time's taking its toll on both of us.
Well, I wanted to get out there to see that. That was at the fairgrounds, but
I understand they had around 6,000 people there.
Well, that's good.
Big crowd.
That's good.
Which is good.
In fact, they had the Temptations and a few old-time rock groups the night before in town, and so everything, and they have the parade. The parade seemed to be a little better this year.
That's what I understand, and they had a lot of activities for the people in addition to just the UFO activities. If people wanted to come here, there was a lot to do.
Now, let's talk about what's happening in your life with ufology. I've been reading your editorials.
Still writing them about every other month, and I'm now taking on the approach of trying to get after some of these people that are putting out misinformation and disinformation.
Yeah, we talked about that. We did that on the last show, and what's the latest on that?
Well, I'm getting pretty positive feedback, surprisingly. It's time that the researchers do this, the serious researchers, because we're spending so much time putting out fires from people who don't have the knowledge or don't have the research, and yet have the ability to get out and spread the word on things that they can't back up. And that bothers me as a serious researcher. So I have gone public with it, and privately it didn't work in the past, so I just decided to go public and take my chances with it.
And I know we were talking to Stanton Friedman the other morning at breakfast, and he was talking about some of these people look like, you know, they're really telling you they're every honest to God truth, known to mankind. They look like you could pass a lie detector test, and none of it's true.
A good example is the Roswell incident. There's over 2,000 websites on the Roswell incident. And of those, I would wager that 80% are probably done by people who have never been to Roswell, never interviewed a witness, don't know where the crash sites are or anything else. It's second, third-hand research.
Well, you got a good point there. 2,000, huh?
2,000 websites, and luckily I understand I have one of the top 10.
Well, I'm sure you do, and that's let's give that website for our radio listeners. We have a link on the website.
www.truthseeker@roswell.com.
truthseeker@roswell.com. Now, Dennis, what's the latest project? You were up in Aztec again this year, I know.
I was Master of Ceremonies, and they have a new board there. The Aztec Symposium is set up to benefit the public library in Aztec, and they just elected a new board for the committee and have already started making plans for next March for the next symposium.
So it's going to go on again. Good.
It is.
It's been doing it for some time now.
And Aztec, like Stanton Friedman and I have talked about, years past, Aztec was one of those incidents that we weren't sure about, but the more research that's being done, the more it looks like it's an actual event that did take place, and we're getting some good information with some of the researchers that are working on it.
Well, I know one of the things that you are an expert on, or at least
watch that word.
Yeah, you specialize in studying and researching is underground bases, things like that, and there's one close to there.
I was fortunate.
Supposedly.
This weekend I was fortunate with Dr. Salter, Richard Salter, being in town. I had communicated with him several times by email and phone over the years, and finally got to meet him, but the one you're referring to is up at Dulce. And there's a lot of rumors about seven levels below ground, biogenetics taking place there, and things like that. And this base, if it exists, is located on the Jicarilla Apache Indian Reservation, which would be a good location for security because of the federal laws, the Native American laws, and the state laws to cover it. So it's probably one of those locations that is going to be extremely hard to find and get information about.
Yeah, you got three different sets of laws, like you say. If one doesn't get you, the other one probably will.
Right, and they will use them just like they do out at Area 51 if they need to.
I heard, and this is another place where you're an expert on, and we'll get into that in a minute. But okay, you specialize in that.
That's a better word.
Oh, okay. And let me ask you about that Dulce rumor that there's a nice hotel up there or something in the middle of nowhere.
There is a 3-star, 4-star hotel in Dulce, and I had tried to work a deal to get up there with two other researchers, one from North Carolina and one from Georgia, and we were going to go up there under the cover of a hunting trip or a fishing trip or something like that to snoop around a little bit. And I got a call from the one guy in Georgia saying that he's getting out of the Dulce research completely. Reason being, he's getting a lot of threatening phone calls, and he's having near accidents and things like that anytime he mentions Dulce. So somebody apparently is putting some pressure on him, and it's something we need to look at carefully. Don't want to publicly let anybody know if we decide to go up and when we decide to go.
Well, gee, that lets me out.
Well, I can give you after the fact.
Oh, okay, Jerry, I may go up there with you.
I had a man up there 2 years ago that came up to me. He knew I was interested in Dulce, and he was a Native American. And he said, "I understand you're interested in Dulce." I said, "I am." He said, "Well, I'm a guide." And I said, "Well, I'd like to talk to you." And he said he'd be willing to work with me, but he wanted to wait a few years for some reason. He didn't tell me why. So I'm going to buy a little time on it and then get a hold of him and see if maybe we can do some research.
Yeah, you'd like to find out more about that place. All kinds of things in New Mexico. I guess that's one reason you came here.
It is, and it's New Mexico itself is probably one of the best-kept secrets in the country. But the activity that takes place in New Mexico is unbelievable. You have two national labs in Sandia and Los Alamos, White Sands Missile Range, which is highly technical and highly secretive at places, Holloman Air Force Base, where the stealth F-117 is housed, the base over at Clovis, the VLA, the very large array, the dishes that are listening for signals from space is out of Sequoia.
Yeah, New Mexico has got lots of history behind it, especially in UFOs. I've heard of reports of as many as 10 reported crashes in this state.
Larry Hatch has a website where he has sightings plotted on a map from different years. He has individual states, he has the United States, he has different countries, and it's amazing how many sightings back in the 1940s, particularly 1947, took place. I think there's about 15 or 20 just in New Mexico back in 1947.
Yeah, so this is of course, back in those days, this was the place where, I guess, nuclear weapons were, and all of the research was going on, and lots of things we didn't know.
The only atomic bomb group in the world was stationed here after they dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki to end the Second World War. The Enola Gay was stationed here. The runway here at the base is 13,000 feet, which is one of the longer runways in the country.
Almost as long as
Area 51.
Right.
Half. Yeah, half. We don't know what they're bringing in at Area 51, yeah. But the runway is 30,000 feet. But this was a very vital base at the time. There's 12 missile silos stationed around the city here that were in use back in the 60s. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, the B-52 sat on the runway out here for 72 hours, engines idling, crews on board, atomic bombs loaded. Had the word come down, they would have been airborne in 3 minutes.
So when you came to Roswell, you obviously, we all have preconceived ideas about what happened here. Now you've lived here some time and you've investigated it. Hour after hour after hour, has your mind changed at all from the time your preconceived notion about Roswell till now?
I think the biggest change is the fact that I now have no doubt that something extremely important happened here. Up until the time I moved here, it was reading books or doing research other ways that I could read and get information, but after moving up here, working at the museum as a volunteer for 2.5 years, meeting a lot of the first-hand witnesses, meeting the researchers like Stanton Friedman and John Schmidt that have been active with it, I have no doubt that what happened in 1947 did happen and is still covered up. What I cannot tell you is what it was. The rumors are, and the stories from the witnesses are, that it was a craft of unknown origin, extraterrestrial. We're pretty well convinced it wasn't anything of the United States. It wasn't anything of Russia. So it would be something that we need to find out.
From Roswell, New Mexico, one of our good friends, Dennis Balthizer, is here. And Dennis, we talked about several things in the opening segment, but you know, you talk about, I like to talk about conspiracies, let's say it that way, more than you do. I mean, that's kind of one of my pets. But you've had some encounters of conspiracies. We ran across that Stillwater story several times when you went to...
Perhaps that's why I don't like talking about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right. And have you had any, you know, we're talking about your friend that was going to go up and research with you in Dulce. He kind of backed out because of intimidating phone calls and things. Has anyone ever contacted you like that?
Well, with that interception, I had the phone call 6 months later saying not to mess with the Air Force, back off. And I am currently working with a gentleman in California who we're doing some checking, trying to get names and locations of the people I dealt with. And if that's possible, then one or two scenarios is involved with that thing in Stillwater. If they were real agents, we have a cover-up, without a doubt, 50-some years later. If they were not, then we have a hoax or a scam, and I want to prosecute because they're impersonating federal agents.
Yeah, now let's, for people who are not aware of the story, you were going to go up there to investigate somebody who actually was going to show you material that could have been from an extraterrestrial craft.
Right. I was with the museum at the time as a UFO investigator, and we got a call from a gentleman who said his daddy was stationed here as an MP, had a piece of the metal, guarded the ambulances, saw the bodies, saw one walk into the hospital with doctors and things like that. So I made arrangements to go to Oklahoma to meet him, get him on tape, get the metal and have it tested. And when I got over there, I wasn't able to make contact. I kept getting a recording on the phone, and finally I was contacted and told to meet him at Denny's restaurant at 7 o'clock. And when I got there, a man and woman said, "Are you Dennis?" I said, "Yes." He said, "The gentleman you plan on meeting will not be here." So when I asked who they were, they said they were special agents of the United States Air Force Office of Special Investigation. When I said, "How did you know I was coming over?" He said, "We knew Monday you'd be here Friday." So as my phone tapped, he smiled and said, "You know how we do business." So this has been 7 years ago, and it's still under investigation because we're still trying to locate who the people were. And particularly, I'm interested in what their motive was, because usually a hoax or a scam is a big splash to embarrass you or make a fool out of you, where this was pretty low-key and hush-hush and kept under the rug pretty much. They weren't any publicity with it or anything like that. So we're looking to try to find out who they were. If we can locate them, I have a contact with the FBI, and I would hope that the Air Force would get behind me also, because impersonating federal agents is a pretty serious offense. And if we can prove that, then I want to prosecute and put them away.
We're talking with Dennis Balthizer here. It's truthseeker@roswell.com. I got it right.
You got it.
Sometimes I try to put that S in there and make it plural for some reason. But it's not, folks. It's just truthseeker@roswell.com. Let's talk about some of your other projects that you're on. I don't know about the pyramid deal. What's happening there? This fellow came to you and asked you about joining their team for pyramid research.
I was recommended by Jeff Renz of Sightings on the Radio, and they were looking for someone to put on the advisory board that has some knowledge of ufology. And Jeff recommended me, which I was appreciative of. There's thoughts and talk about the pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx not being Egyptian. This is going to be a hard sell because of Egyptian tourism, but we're pretty well convinced that the three pyramids of Giza and the Sphinx are predating the Egyptian civilization. There was a civilization there known as Kemetians. Prior to the Egyptian civilization in North Africa, and we have heard rumors that they had contact with star people. So I'm not by any means saying that extraterrestrials built the pyramids, but I am saying the technology could have been transferred from star people to the Kemetians in order to help build those things.
Where does this stand at this point? Has anybody made it over there yet?
We have a group going over in November. Unfortunately, I don't have the money. I'm losing too much money doing research to go.
We understand.
But there is a group going back in November. Stephen Mueller, I think Joe Parr, and a few others are going over and going to do some research. And they do this every so many years and then come back and go public with the information they've obtained.
Well, we look forward to hearing from them, and they'll be talking to you.
Yes.
You'll be giving them some of your expertise, because you were a highway engineer, wasn't it? Right.
I had 33 years with the Texas Highway Department of Civil Engineering, 3 years in the Army Engineering Battalion prior to that. So that's one of the reasons I got into the underground bases, because of the technology and the equipment that they use. I was curious to see if I could find anything out about that.
Have you literally or physically found an underground base yet for yourself?
Well, we know there's some down at White Sands. There's at least 4 levels at White Sands, because they've been doing some laser testing in the 4th level at White Sands. There could be 7 levels there. Dilsey is supposed to have 7 levels below ground.
And supposedly that's where the famous fight took place.
The Schneider, where they encountered the Greys. Area 51, 22 levels below ground, Edwards Air Force Base, and some of the bases in California are up to 35 levels below ground.
Wow.
And these are things that I can understand because of satellites. We have to go underground. Other countries do it also. The Russians have some, the Koreans have some. We have to do this secretive work away from the eyes of satellites of our adversaries. So it's something that has to be done, and it's being done by many countries.
How do you feel about the whole situation? You've been investigating this for a while, and the situation, when I say the whole situation, I'm talking about the idea that time is really eating away at the Roswell witnesses. They're not around anymore.
The mortician's winning the battle, yeah. Just this past week, we lost Elizabeth Tulk. Your listeners don't know who Elizabeth Tulk is, but Elizabeth was Sheriff Wilcox's daughter, one of his 2 daughters. And I had the good fortune of meeting Elizabeth and Phyllis a couple of years ago, and going through the old Sheriff Wilcox office and residence where they lived behind the courthouse. And they explained to us how their dad worked in that building, and their mother did the cooking for the prisoners. The jail was upstairs above their residence. And
so they literally lived in the jail.
They did, back in the 40s. Mm-hmm. And we asked the girls, Phyllis and Elizabeth, if they would go up to the jail portion with us. And surprisingly, both women, who were in their late 70s at the time, said, "No, we're not going up there. Daddy told us that wasn't a place for women." Mm-hmm. Which just really hit me, because, 50 years later,
half of the inmates are women. No,
they still believe their daddy's words when he said they had no business going up
there.
It
may be one reason they haven't talked a whole lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand the sheriff went around and intimidated the civilian witnesses by saying, he get killed, and he had a Green Bay Packer looking guard with him.
And he decided not to run for re-election as sheriff, and his wife ran and lost. This incident moved him so much that he didn't even run for re-election. And he was interrogated. They had come to the sheriff's office and confiscated some of the material, armed military people. So it changed his life also, like it has many people. Last year, 2 years ago, we lost Frank Kaufman, who we thought was a key witness with intelligence. Turns out that most of his stuff was hoax that he had worked up his own paperwork on. And I'm thinking about trying to do another editorial in the next month or two on some of the witnesses that we're losing, and the fact that we are losing these witnesses.
How many of these witnesses turned out to be just joining the parade,
Well, one of the problems, several problems involved with witnesses.
I mean, sometimes you do that by, they see a little bit and they talk to other people.
Embellish it.
Yeah, right. I mean, that just happens.
I'll give you a good example of that. James Bond Johnson, who took the pictures in General Ramey's office. I did an in-depth interview with him a few years ago and have it on my website. Kevin Randall had also done an interview with him. And between my interview, Kevin Randall's interview, and another interview, his story has completely changed. James Bond Johnson took the pictures in General Ramey's office in Fort Worth in 1947. That's a fact. But that's all he did. But if you listen to his story today, he's more involved. He, in fact, claimed at one time that he had given the piece of paper to General Ramey that Ramey was holding that we're looking at today. Then he came back when I questioned him about that, and he said, well, he was probably wrong about that. But the information had gone out. Memory loss is a problem. The guys are getting older. They're in their late 70s or early 80s if they're still alive, and I'm getting in the age now where I know what memory loss is, too.
Now, who are you again?
I can't remember.
No, that's a good point. It is.
And it's memory loss is a real thing, and to determine the difference between memory loss, embellishment, and fact are tough research situations.
Well, Dennis Malpizer is our guest. This is the UFO Files. We're in Roswell, New Mexico. Dennis is home now. And Dennis, let's talk about Roswell for a little bit. You've been here a long time, and sometimes you run across these great stories by accident that check out. I know as a researcher that happens.
It does. The interesting thing to me, since I've been here and really been keying on this Roswell incident, is the witnesses, when we get a name for the first time, we get excited because we finally found somebody else that was here that's new that we haven't interviewed before. So we'll call them, or I'll try to call them. And when I get a hold of them, I'll tell them that I'm a UFO researcher and I understand you were at Roswell in 1947. Invariably, I will be told, no, I wasn't there. And then I'll tell them, I'm looking at the 1947 Roswell Army Airfield yearbook. Your picture is on page such and such. Your rank was, you were in this squadron, and then they know I have them. And then the next thing they'll usually tell me is, okay, I was there, but I'm not going to talk about it. And when I question that, there's several reasons. The main one is I promised my government I wouldn't talk, and they won't. And I have to respect them. A lot of researchers don't. A lot of researchers will push the envelope there and usually make them mad, and they'll never get any information. But I try to respect that because I wish today that we had that respect for our government.
Well, you got a good point. So you, at that point, kind of soft-pedal it, but I bet you come back to them.
I do, and I give them...
somehow I felt that.
I give them the opportunity to get comfortable, the knowing, and I'll tell them, I'll keep it confidential if you want to keep it confidential, but I have a few questions, and then we'll go into some questions. Sometimes they'll give me answers, sometimes they won't, and I have to take what I give.
Mm-hmm. Anytime in the past come to mind when... Yeah, you thought, well, this guy's not going to tell me anything, and maybe as you're getting ready to leave or hang up the phone or something, he says, by the way, it tells you something. That happens to me a lot.
Yeah, I've had those, but the one that would really kick the audience, I think, is Mac Brazel, the rancher. When he was brought, when he came back into town after Major Marcel and Cabot had been out at the site, he was interrogated down here at the base for 5 or 6 days. And he had done an interview with the radio station prior to going to that interrogation. And when they turned him loose to go back to the ranch, he stopped at the radio station and told them that his story wasn't true the way he originally told it, that he had been wrong in the dates and things like that. And the station owner said, Mac, are you talking about those little green men? And they said Mac Brazel spun on his cowboy boots and looked at the radio station owner and said they weren't green. In fact, it's the only reference that I'm aware of where Mac Brazel made any reference to bodies, but the fact that he said they weren't green tells me that he did see them.
In fact, I think his son was quoted as saying one time about the he felt sorry for those poor little creatures
right,
or something.
Right. And there's another one. We were talking earlier about losing these witnesses. His son passed away within the last few years, Bill Brazel. And Bill was also one of those that had a piece of metal, bragged about it, and the next thing you know, the military is there demanding it and getting rid of it.
Did he ever talk to anybody about that metal? Is that where we learned that it had these strange
memory, the memory quality? It's the same stuff. In fact, Bill, the son of Mac Brazel, had gone out on horseback, I think, after a rare rainstorm here, and had found this laying out in the pasture and had taken it back to the house, to the ranch. And
this is after the Air Force had cleared the area, or the Army,
after having cleared. And I think he went into one of the bars in Corona or somewhere and bragged about it. And within a short period of time, he's visited by the military, and they told him they wanted it.
Word gets around.
D. Proctor, who was Loretta Proctor's son, and went out to the debris field with Mac Brazel the morning after the crash, was about 11 years old at the time. Don Schmidt and I have tried to interview him on many occasions. And if he finds out we're coming, he's unavailable. If he sees us driving up, he's out the back door. We just cannot get with the man. He doesn't want to talk about it. However, you put yourself in his position as a young boy in the military, telling you if you talk about this, your parents are dead or something like that. You know, it's a frightening situation.
So, do you think we'll ever know for sure what happened here?
Good question. Up until fairly recently, I was hopeful that within my lifetime, we would know what happened. My latest theory, which is something that I've thought about for years, on the Roswell incident is whatever we recovered in 1947, I'm not sure that we know today what we have or if we know what it is. And if that's the case, I don't think our military and our government will go public with anything until they get all the military benefit out of it. We have nothing in our day-to-day life that the military hasn't already used. Technology, from the military standpoint, advances about 15 years for every calendar year. So military technology is way ahead of anything else. But I really believe that we possibly have material from this craft that we haven't completely figured out what it is, where it's from, who it is, or anything like that. And until we can get the military benefit out of it, which we have to have since we have captured it, I don't think they'll go public. And also, it'll open a can of worms. There are so many things that our government, I'll be honest, they've lied to us about over the years. At lectures, I usually tell young people that anyone up to the age of 35 or 40 doesn't understand cover-up, because they're growing up with it. Iran-Contra, Vietnam, Watergate, Kennedy assassination. I mean, it's a whole list. Nearly everything our government does today is in a cover-up form. So young people don't understand that. They're growing up with it and have accepted it. But 50 years ago, these guys that were involved in this were a special breed and trusted and respected the government.
And you know, it sounds, almost naive to think that somebody would be quiet because of patriotism, but back in those days especially.
Oh, yeah. We just came out of the Second World War. We had a lot of pride in our military, in our pride in our government, and our leaders. At lectures many times, I'll say, name five people in the government you respect, and I get a blank look back.
Mm-hmm.
That's unfortunate. I'm not doing it to be amusing. It's just something that really gets your attention when you stop and think about it. Most people can't name five people that they respect.
There's another thing, and I haven't mentioned this to you in our many conversations, but there's the corporate side of this equation, too. There's money to be made out of these things that they back engineer and find, and so that may be reasons why they keep things covered up.
A lot of people ask, why don't they make contact with us? If they're here or have been here, why don't they contact us? My immediate response is, why would they want to? I don't know what we have to offer. We're the only species on the planet that can't get along with each other and destroying the planet as fast as we can. So maybe they're watching to see us self-destruct. I don't know. But I think it would have a tremendous impact on the financial world, on religions of the world. No one country wants to give up their dedication to something from another planet. We need to start thinking of ourselves as humans rather than as nations, and as, I don't want to go with the one world phrase, but we've become so small, our planet has become so small, and communication is so technologically advanced.
Provincialism or nationalism is outdated. We just haven't figured that out. Dennis Balthizer, always great to have you here on the UFO Files, and always in person. It's wonderful. We are in Roswell, and Dennis, let's talk a little bit about what you're working on now.
Well, you know my webmaster, Faye, and...
Yeah, she's quite a delight and very talented.
She's amazing. She really is. She's an artist, and I write some text, and she puts some pictures on it or some artwork, and from there we have a good site. But her and her husband had the idea of trying to syndicate some radio shows for me, and we have been working on 3 CDs where we're doing 3-minute shows. And we're putting a month's worth of shows on a CD and sending packages out to radio stations all over the country, hoping they'll accept it and start using it. And what they are is a quick 3-minute question and answer session about my research.
Well, that's good, because Ronald Reagan started that way, you know. That's how he got...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did. When he decided to get in politics, he started sending out the 3-minute shows. Radio stations started carrying them, and the next thing you know, he's making plenty of money off of that show.
That's not a bad example.
Yeah, right. So, there's room in radio for that. It's just a matter of getting people to buy.
We're finding that the program directors have such a tight schedule on radio program that it's hard to slip something else in unless they have a need for it.
Yeah, and the need for it is somebody buying some time.
Right. we're hopeful that we can get some play out of it. I think my biggest thrill, Jerry, is not... It's doing interviews such as this one. It's doing lectures. This weekend, I was at the Civic Center all weekend selling my tapes, and the biggest kick I got was the people that would come up and talk to me. Because as a serious researcher, I can talk to them about things that I'm aware of, and answer questions for them that maybe they haven't had answered before. And I think the questions and answers after lectures are my biggest challenge that I love the most, because you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you do this very long at a time, you realize that you don't dismiss anybody.
I judge my research by radio shows and the response we get from that, and then the lectures, the questions and answers. And the editorials, I get a lot of responses on editorials. I'll have people call me from or email me from all over the world, and sometimes don't know how they read them or where they found them, but I'll get some good positive feedback.
Well, let's talk about those editorials and sounding off. What have you been sounding off against recently? I know about the fraudulent behavior of some UFO researchers.
Well, I pushed the envelope this last editorial in one that I wrote entitled UFO Research and Christian Faith. And in there I made mention of having Christian faith myself and having had it for years, and also doing UFO research and not having a problem with it. I think a lot of people are brought up in a box and don't want to come out of that box, and I obviously have been out of the box for a long time. But I think the two go together. If you really look at both the UFO research and Christian faith, I think they can be tied together very good. Most people don't realize the largest UFO library in the world is at the Vatican in Rome. Some of the Monsignors from the Catholic Church have gone public.
Don't they have a telescope in Arizona?
They have two big telescopes and 5 observatories around the world. They have a tremendous one out in Arizona and are building another one. So they have a lot of interest in space and exploration and what's out there and planets and things like that. So I think they're trying to get into the scientific world, and hopefully the scientific world will accept it.
We're talking with Dennis Balthizer here, and basically we're talking about Roswell, but you do other things. Area 51 research, you're one of the top ones in that area, too, as far as I'm concerned. Is that place still as active as it ever was, you think?
To my knowledge, it is. Chuck Clark lives up at Rachel, and him and I put together a display for the museum where I wrote the text and he furnished the pictures. And Chuck informed me not too long ago that they just built a brand new water tank, storage tank up there because of a need for water. And I'm guessing that maybe the water up around the base is possibly contaminated because of all the toxic waste they've had and things like that.
Well, they've had a lot of activity over the years, that's for sure. So,
there's been rumors that it moved to Utah, but there's no indication of that. I think it's normal for them to move personnel. If they run out of a project, I think a lot of times they'll move personnel to White Sands or to Edwards or some other location.
Dennis, it's been a joy having you on today.
My pleasure.
And we've got about a minute left, so let's talk about your projects. They can always check everything on your website at truthseeker@roswell.com. All one word.
Right.
Small letters.
Right.
truthseeker@roswell.com. And has since your editorial has been in the MUFON Journal?
They have. They recently picked up my editorials. I'm currently distributing them to about 16 websites and a few magazines. And it's always a pleasure to be on your show, Jerry. You do a good job, and I appreciate you having me on, letting me share my research with your audience. And I wish you good luck with it.
Well, when you get that little camping trip up there to Dulce underway, under the guise of being a hunter, let me know.
I think I'm going to go to Oklahoma and go fishing first.
Okay, that's a good place to go fishing. And with that, we're going to close it out. Dennis Balthizer, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening, folks, to the UFO File.